Good morning. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Paul Weick, and I will be reading today's Wall Street Journal with you. Today is October 9th. Some of the articles we will be reading. Israel and Hamas agree to hostage release and step toward peace. Inside the Justice Department, where the president calls the shots. A Wall Street Journal article on Hyundai gets cold shoulder from Trump despite charm offensive. And in Heard on the Street, how Trump threw a wrench into credit markets. There are many other articles and opinion pieces as well. We'll see what we have time to get to. But let's go ahead and start with our first story. Israel and Hamas agree to hostage release and step toward peace. This is on the front page. And it is by Summer Saeed and Anat Peled. And Ayir Ayub. Here is the article. Israel and Hamas agreed Wednesday to a deal that would release all Israeli hostages held in the Gaza Strip in the first step toward peace after 2 years of war in the Palestinian territory. President Trump said the hostages will be released soon and that Israel will withdraw its troops in the Strip to an agreed-upon area. Hamas confirmed that a broad deal steered by U.S. envoys had been reached to end the war, allow more humanitarian aid, and facilitate a prisoner exchange, as they put it, a reference to the release of Israeli hostages for Palestinians in Israeli prisons. Egyptian officials who mediated the talks said Hamas would let the remaining living hostages go as soon as Sunday morning. Trump said in an interview with Fox News that the hostages would probably be released on Monday. This is a great day for the Arab and Muslim world, Israel, all surrounding nations, and the United States of America, Trump said in a post on his Truth Social site. The president's announcement marks a breakthrough in what had been 8 months of stalled negotiations after he took office, bringing Trump closer to a top foreign policy goal of ending the war in Gaza. It came together in less than a month after an Israeli strike on Qatar, a U.S. ally that harbors Hamas officials, led to heightened fears that the war was spinning out of control and brought new pressure on Israel from Trump and on Hamas from leaders in the Muslim world. Trump employed some of his most trusted advisors, a friend real estate investor Steve Witkoff and his son-in-law Jared Kushner, to bridge the gaps leading to Wednesday's announcement. It is believed that there are 20 living hostages of about 250 people that were kidnapped on October 7, 2023, when Hamas and other Palestinian factions launched a surprise assault on Israel that killed about 1,200 people. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would hold a vote with his government to ratify the deal on Thursday. A great deal day for Israel, he said. With God's help, together we will continue to achieve all of our goals and expand peace with our neighbors. That's the end of his quote. Hamas's statement hinted at major details yet to be worked out, and Egyptian officials said mediators were working to hash out a final agreement that could still get derailed. Among the final issues are the return of an estimated 28 bodies of hostages, the list of Palestinian prisoners to be released in exchange, and perhaps most important, how far Israel will have to pull its troops back and how to guarantee the war won't start again. Since the deal focuses on freeing the hostages, the agreement does not mention Palestinian statehood. In previous deals in November 2023 and January 2025, hostages were released in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, but the ceasefire agreements eventually broke down. Hamas wants clearer timelines and commitments for the withdrawal of the Israeli military. It also says it would need at least 10 days to locate bodies of dead hostages, according to people close to the talks. Israeli officials believe it will be difficult for Hamas to locate all the remaining bodies of hostages and will take more time. Egyptian officials said the partial deal announced on Wednesday would be a stopgap to keep talks from collapsing over more difficult issues such as disarming Hamas. U.S. officials asked the mediators to warn Hamas that the talks would end if no agreement is reached by the end of the week. Earlier in the day at the White House, Trump was interrupted while speaking to reporters and handed a note by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. After reading it, the president said, "We're very close to a deal in the Middle East." The note encouraged the president to approve a Truth Social post so he would be the first to announce a deal, according to a photograph. White House officials said Trump is considering going to Egypt, where the talks have been hosted, after his annual checkup at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center on Friday. He did not rule out visiting Gaza during his trip. The deal was struck on the third day of talks in the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Witkoff and Kushner arrived Wednesday along with Qatar's Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani and Ron Dermer, Netanyahu's top advisor. The talks follow from Israel and Hamas tentatively accepting a 20-point peace plan announced by Trump last week. If the plan is adopted, Trump would chair a board of peace that would oversee the interim governance of Gaza. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair would play a role in that effort. Representatives for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and from Palestinian Islamic Jihad, groups that hold some of the Israeli hostages, were also in Egypt for the talks. There were scattered celebrations in Gaza where it was 2 a.m. when Trump made his announcement, according to video on Arabic television channels. But some Gazans were cautious about getting their hopes up. "I feel that this agreement might collapse in the upcoming stages. I'm not very optimistic. I'm worried," said Ahmed Humaid, 35 years old, in the Gaza city of Nusrat. "I won't be surprised if Israel takes all the hostages and then goes back to the war. I understand people are happy that the airstrikes might stop, but they don't think of the upcoming days." That's the end of his quote. More than 67,000 Palestinians have died in the war, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, which does not break out civilian and militant deaths. Hamas on Wednesday sought to assure Gazans, quote, that "our people's sacrifices will not be in vain," end quote. "We will not abandon our national rights until freedom, independence, and self-determination are achieved," Hamas said. And that was the lead story. Israel and Hamas agreed to hostage release in Step Toward Peace, and it was written by Summer Saeed, Anat Peled, and Abir Ayub. Our next article is inside the Justice Department, where the president calls the shots. And it is reported by Josh Dossi, Sadie Gurman, and Aruna Viswanatha. And the dateline is Washington. In his second term, President Trump has taken control of the Justice Department in ways he could have only dreamed of during his first. Then he publicly railed against senior department officials, but largely heeded the Council of Aides who urged him to trust the legal process. This term, all it took was one errant post to get what he wanted. On September 20th, Trump meant to send a private message to Attorney General Pam Bondi, urging her to prosecute former FBI Director James Comey and his other favored targets, according to U.S. officials familiar with the matter. "We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility," Trump wrote. Trump believed he had sent Bondi the message directly, addressing it to Pam, and was surprised to learn that it was public, the officials said. Bondi grew upset and called White House aides and Trump, who then agreed to send a second post praising Bondi as doing a, quote, "great job," close quote. The misfire provided a window into how, through command and chaos, Trump has executed a wholesale transformation of the Justice Department. 5 days after that Saturday evening message, Comey was indicted. When asked about the message at a congressional hearing this week, Bondi said, "I don't think he said anything that he hasn't said for years." Comey pleaded not guilty to charges of false statements and obstruction on Wednesday. His lawyer said he intends to argue the case was brought solely because of Trump's animus toward him. Trump officials have already ousted dozens of senior Justice Department prosecutors who ran afoul of him in Washington and New York, but a Virginia district earned Trump's particular ire last month after the U.S. attorney he had appointed there did not find probable cause to prosecute Comey. Trump ignored the advice of aides, Justice Department officials, and even Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, who had urged him to keep on the prosecutor, Eric Siebert, according to people familiar with the discussions. After Siebert resigned under pressure, Trump installed in the post a former personal lawyer, Lindsey Halligan, who had never prosecuted a criminal case. A spokesman for Youngkin said the governor fully respects the president's authority to choose the best U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. That was a quote. Meanwhile, Trump's Justice Department appointees have pressed for action in investigations of a range of other perceived enemies, viewing it as an appropriate response to the years of criminal cases Trump faced, some of which were based on novel legal theories. Prosecutors in Maryland are expected in coming days to charge one of Trump's first-term national security advisors, John Bolton, who is now a top Trump critic, with mishandling classified information, according to people familiar with the matter. In Virginia, prosecutors are expected to seek an indictment of New York Attorney General Letitia James, who won a civil fraud case against Trump on mortgage fraud charges that Siebert and others saw as weak, people familiar with the case said. James has denied wrongdoing. Other prosecutors are investigating former CIA Director John Brennan, another prominent Trump critic, and former FBI Director Christopher Wray, who was originally appointed by Trump, but then enraged conservatives who came to believe he had wielded the Bureau's powers against them. Former officials have received subpoenas in recent days in the Wray inquiry, according to a person with direct knowledge of the matter. On Wednesday, Trump said the Democratic leaders of Chicago and Illinois also should be imprisoned. For decades, the Justice Department has kept the White House at arm's length from prosecutorial decisions. In Trump's first term, officials resisted pursuing such cases, in part because they understood that if they breached ethical norms, those same tactics could be directed at Republicans in the future, said Sarah Isker, who served as a Justice Department spokeswoman then. Trump hasn't changed. What's different is the people he appointed, she said, adding that the current department leadership was handling Trump's political opponents even handing Trump's political opponents even greater power to abuse. This is an observation from an alternate reality because Democrats have in fact abused their power to target President Trump and Republicans, a Justice Department spokesman said. Bondi and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche also represented Trump personally before receiving their current jobs. They have fired dozens of prosecutors and Federal Bureau of Investigation agents who worked on investigations of Trump or were perceived to be liberal. Dozens more have resigned, concerned they would be asked to take actions that could result in their disbarment. The section tasked with public corruption investigations is down from 30 prosecutors to 2 full-time, and the National Security Division has lost about half its personnel. Both were involved in cases against Trump or his allies. This Department of Justice is committed to ending the weaponization and restoring one tier of justice for all Americans, a spokesman for the agency said. And White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said Trump appreciates Bondi and Blanche for, quote, all of their hard work to make our country safe again and restore accountability in our previously broken justice system, end of Leavitt's quote. One official with particular influence is Federal Housing Finance Agency Director Bill Pulte, who has brought allegations of mortgage fraud by Trump's foes to the president. Pulte has even showed up on the weekend at Trump's golf course in Virginia, bypassing frustrated aides in order to get to the president. He has used that access to talk to Trump, even at one point bringing a job candidate to meet with Trump directly, officials said. Pulte has clashed with a range of senior administration officials across the government. This summer, Pulte visited the White House and gave Trump an elaborate presentation with visuals that included why the New York Attorney General should be charged. Siebert had assessed there was not a strong case. In a statement, Pulte praised Bondi and Blanche as great lawyers who have represented and continue to serve President Trump exceptionally well, and said he looks forward to continuing to work productively with their team. Working behind the scenes with Pulte is Ed Martin, a Missouri lawyer whose vocal advocacy for the January 6th rioters cost him the job of the U.S. attorney in Washington. Trump appointed him to an even more powerful slot at Justice Department headquarters, doubling as both a special prosecutor pursuing matters of interest to Trump and the pardon attorney. He works from an office dubbed the Freedom Suite on one end of a hallway on the Deputy Attorney General's fourth floor, which visitors have described as being decorated with oversized photos of Trump and a small cup of holy water on the wall. Martin has taken unusual steps in investigations, for example, showing up outside James's Brooklyn home in a trench coat resembling that of TV police Lieutenant Columbo, and posing for photos that appeared in the media. Last month, Martin sent a letter to a lawyer for an FBI agent who was among the first on the scene at the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, questioning his role in a defamation lawsuit against conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Blanche told Martin to rescind that letter, which he did. Martin has complained to White House officials that he has too few staff and resources. Blanche has sent Martin at least one who quit, citing difficulties working with Martin, according to people familiar with the disputes. But Martin also has a direct line to the president. Trump often calls Martin directly to talk about the investigations, people familiar with the calls said, earning his trust in 2016 after convincing now-deceased conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly to throw her support behind Trump. A department spokesman said leadership was, quote, united as one team with a singular mission, close quote, of advancing Trump's agenda. Martin said he was grateful for Bondi and Blanche's confidence and support. Bondi, the 59-year-old former Florida attorney general, has walked a fine line with Trump. She has traveled with Trump to sporting events, but tried to avoid discussing cases directly with him, telling him that case decisions are largely up to the deputy attorney general. Trump occasionally reminds aides about an incident last year in which Trump cut his hand on Bondi's large wedding ring, causing him to bleed. Bondi visits the White House once or twice a week, allies say. She recently worked out of her chief of staff's conference room for several days after complaining of mold in the attorney general's suite, and sometimes runs home during the day to take care of her dogs. Privately, Trump has acknowledged that he believes Blanche is a solid lawyer and Bondi appears great on TV, but has continued to complain to aides about the pace of the cases, even after the Comey indictment. Aides have reminded him about work in progress. She's moving too slow, Trump has said about Bondi, according to administration officials. And that's the end of that article, Inside the Justice Department, Where the President Calls the Shots, reported by Josh Dossi, Sadie Gurman, and Aruna Viswanatha. And I'll remind you that you're listening to The Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm your volunteer reader, Paul Weick. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org and then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now, back to the next article. And let's see, let's go to this article in the business section, How Businesses Are Already Feeling Shutdown Pain. From medical device maker to marketers, companies feeling the pinch of stalled contracts. It's reported by Ruth Simon, Theo Francis, and Lauren Weber. Just a week into the U.S. government shutdown, businesses nationwide are starting to feel the pain. An Alameda, California medical device company postponed a planned spinoff, unable to pursue regulatory approvals. A Florida marketing company laid off 5 employees after receiving a stop work order on a federal contract. A Minnesota subcontractor is trying to keep a half dozen electricians working while it waits for a stalled government contract. The shutdown is disrupting business as usual in many ways and reinforcing just how many private sector operations depend on a federal bureaucracy humming on all cylinders. Government-backed small business lending has ground to a halt. Agencies can't award or make payments on many new contracts. Scheduled workplace safety inspections are on hold, and so are many regulatory reviews. Small government subcontractors, such as Brian Butler's marketing and communications firm, said they are already being hit and don't know when they will be paid for some work done or how long the shutdown will last. That's a very scary place to be in as an entrepreneur, said Butler, whose Lutz, Florida firm, Vistra Communications, employs about 80 people and gets roughly 3/4 of its revenue from the federal government. Butler laid off 5 of his 80 employees last week after the shutdown triggered a stop work order on one of its projects. Butler paid the workers a week of salary and is covering the employees' share of health insurance costs for the month. If I receive 1, 2, 3 more of these, I'm not sure I can do that for that many people, said Butler of the stop work orders. Curtailed operations at the Securities and Exchange Commission have delayed some business plans. Vivani Medical, a tiny company developing drug implants, said it had to pause a planned spinoff of its brain implant subsidiary since it could not continue with registering the spinoff's shares with the SEC. It had recently set Wednesday as the transaction's record date when it would determine which existing shareholders would receive the right to shares in the new company called Cortigent. Vivani, which has a market cap of about $80 million, said it would set a new date once this SEC reopened. Some economists worry the pain could spread to the broader economy if the stalemate stretches into weeks. The shutdown could cut annual economic growth by as much as 0.2 percentage points for every week it lasts, the consulting firm Oxford Economics estimates. Much of that should be recovered when the shutdown ends, assuming the government makes good on delayed invoices and back pay for furloughed workers. Still, the longer it goes on, the more of that hit to growth won't be recovered, said Nancy Vandenhouten, lead U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. Vinco, a telecommunications and electrical subcontractor, learned just over a month ago that it was part of the winning bid for a Minneapolis-St. Paul Air Force Reserve building upgrade. But the shutdown has held up the paperwork needed to process the contract, which would employ 6 to 8 skilled electricians at Vinco for about 9 months. Steve Anderson, president of the Forest Lake, Minnesota company, said he will put the electricians on other jobs even if doing so means overstaffing some projects. That will hurt profit margins at the 300-person company, which receives about 5% of its sales from the federal government. With a brief shutdown, it is hard to find work to fill the gaps. If the shutdown stretches on longer, he added, Vinco might have to lay off workers or take less profitable jobs to keep them. There is such a demand for the specialty electric trades that if you lay them off or send them home, you will lose them, Anderson said. Electricians, plumbers, and other field service professionals frequently count on stable government work to counterbalance less predictable residential business, said Didi Azaria, chief executive of WorkIs, an online platform providing scheduling, invoicing, and other services to such disciplines. About 40% of sales for its 127,000 customers are from commercial or government accounts, and shutdown-related delays are mounting. Every job is getting delayed or they're not getting paid on time, Azaria said. It creates a cash problem, meaning you cannot buy equipment. You cannot pay your employees. That's the end of her quote. Firestarter Studios, a Santa Clarita, California video production company, typically gets about 50% of its revenue from federal contracts. Just days before the budget impasse, Firestarter completed the General Services Administration process that allows it to contract with government agencies at preset rates, an effort that took 2 years and cost roughly $10,000. Now we have nothing to show for it, said owner Rachel Klein, who employs anywhere from a dozen to 200 people at a time. No new business now means no money in 2, 3, or 4 months. Some effects from the shutdown might take longer to surface. At the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, which investigates workplace injuries and deaths, about 460 people are still working without pay out of a staff of 1,664, the Labor Department said. Contingency plans for potential shutdowns in the previous administration called for all of OSHA's inspectors to keep working, said Doug Parker, the OSHA head during the Biden administration. The current staffing level is not enough to respond to all of the complaints, he said. It's going to prevent OSHA from intervening to protect workers, he added. According to the Labor Department's shutdown plan, the department will continue to monitor and respond to imminent threats to human life and continue inspections in high-hazard industries. Businesses that don't work directly with the federal government are also bracing for a pullback in spending as the shutdown continues. We know from past experiences that we will see lower sales than we would have as long as the government shutdown lasts, said Mike Roach, co-owner of Paloma Clothing, a 50-year-old women's clothing retailer in Portland, Oregon, with about 20 full and part-time employees. When consumers are less confident, they spend less money. The shutdown's timing makes things more precarious. Many retailers depend on higher fourth quarter sales in order to stay solvent. I can guarantee you that every small-time retailer like Paloma is pulling their hair out, Roach said. And that's the end of the article, How Businesses Are Already Feeling Shutdown Pain. It was reported by Ruth Simon, Theo Francis, and Lauren Weber. Well, next let's go to Wall Street Journal exclusive article, exclusive reporting. Hyundai gets cold shoulder from Trump despite charm offensive. The Korean car maker is betting big on the U.S. even as new trade and immigration policies pose hurdles. It's reported by Timothy Martin and Jiang San. And the dateline is out of Seoul. Hyundai Motor Group Executive Chair Ai-Soon Chung hoped the automaker could appease the Trump administration with a series of aggressive moves to deepen its ties to the U.S. So far, that looks like a painful miscalculation. The immigration raid last month at Hyundai's Georgia production complex, which resulted in more than 300 white-collar Korean workers in handcuffs and shackles, was the culmination of a year in which the world's third-biggest carmaker repeatedly tried to assuage President Trump, but has little to show for it. Hyundai instead has become one of the most high-profile corporate examples of the pitfalls of trying to anticipate exactly how the administration will implement its often chaotic economic and immigration policies. For Chung, the struggle to get in Washington's good graces is personally vexing as Korea tries to finalize a trade deal that would ease the pain of U.S. tariffs. In recent years, Chung pushed the Korean carmaker founded by his grandfather to make deeper inroads with American consumers. Hyundai and its sister brand Kia, which had once staked their reputation on decade-long warranties and budget prices, racked up design, technology, and quality awards. More than half of the firm's operating profits today come from the U.S. To continue that momentum, Chung followed the corporate playbook for winning over Donald Trump after his election to a second term in November 2024. Hyundai donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration. Weeks later, Hyundai hosted Donald Trump Jr. and his daughter at Torrey Pines for the Pro-Am event of a PGA tournament named after the automaker's luxury sedan. Ahead of looming tariffs, Hyundai in March pledged roughly $21 billion in U.S. investments that would manifest before Trump's second term ended. The investment earned Chung and Hyundai officials a trip to the White House. Trump hailed the investment on social media as proof his tariffs, quote, very strongly work, close quote. But when Trump's 25% tariff on global auto exports was announced days later, Hyundai was not spared. Undeterred, Hyundai took more steps to win favor in Washington. Hyundai said in April that production of a popular SUV would shift from a Kia factory in Mexico to an existing plant in Alabama. It pledged to source more components within the U.S. Hours after South Korea's president met Trump on August 25th at the White House, with Chung in attendance again, Hyundai said it would deliver another $5 billion in American investment. Within days, the search warrant was signed for the September 4th immigration raid at Hyundai's Georgia facility. The arrests unfolded at Chung's crown jewel American project, a $7.6 billion manufacturing complex dubbed the Meta Plant. Federal agents stormed a construction site for a battery plant jointly owned by Hyundai and fellow Korean firm LG Energy Solution. It was the largest such roundup at a single site in U.S. history, roughly 450 arrests, including more than 300 Koreans. A search warrant shows the initial target of the raid was four Hispanic workers. But the effect was a global spotlight on the plant's reliance on Korean labor. Hyundai officials privately admit they would prefer to hire all Americans, though acknowledge that is not realistic because U.S. workers lack the requisite know-how, particularly with EV batteries. The detained South Koreans, Seoul officials say, were largely providing advice on equipment installation and among other tasks in which Americans typically lack expertise. Most of the Korean workers had either short-term business visitor visas or entered the U.S. through a visa waiver program. "I've heard for many, many years that you just can't find American workers in some of these states," said James Kim, chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in South Korea. The raid will delay the site's construction by roughly 2 months. Trump initially said a lot of illegal aliens, that's in quotes, worked at the Georgia site directly after the raid. But he changed his message within days, stressing that certain foreign workers were welcome in the U.S. The release of the 317 detained South Koreans was held up roughly a day, Seoul's foreign ministry said at the time, because Trump had asked them to stay longer to train the Americans. When a charter flight back home left on September 11th from Atlanta, all but one chose to leave. Kush Desai, a White House spokesman, said the U.S. has attracted major investments in various sectors by reducing regulation and enabling companies to bring in technical experts to set up facilities and train up American workers. Quote, "As President Trump has made clear, the administration will work with any company investing in the United States," Desai said. Hyundai is a major factor in the tariff talks between Seoul and Washington, a key barometer for the U.S.'s broader deal-making with dozens of countries. The still-unsigned trade pact with Trump largely centers on a South Korean pledge to invest $350 billion in the U.S. In return, the Trump administration will drop tariffs on a swath of items, including autos, from 25% to 15%. Since the raid, Hyundai has publicly reaffirmed its commitment to $26 billion in U.S. investments, including the still-unfinished Georgia battery site, and its plans to boost American production. That drew Hyundai a strong rebuke from the South Korean government, which thinks Hyundai risks weakening Korea's leverage in trade negotiations with the Trump administration by being too openly enthusiastic for a swift trade resolution, according to people familiar with the matter. South Korea's presidential office declined to comment. Hyundai, in a statement, said it recognizes the efforts of the South Korean government to support local companies' business in the U.S. The carmaker added that next year it will celebrate four decades in the U.S., with its prior and ongoing investments there totaling more than $45 billion. These investment decisions are driven by Hyundai's long-term vision, including a commitment for sustained growth and opportunity in America, the company said. Despite the turmoil, Chung's commitment to the U.S. has remained unchanged, according to people familiar with his thinking. Still, they acknowledge that the current dynamic is more challenging than it appeared at the Metaplant complex's March opening, when Chung stood on a podium with a large American flag hanging behind him. Rows of factory workers donning white hard hats cheered him on. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, attending with other top state officials, autographed a Hyundai EV. "We are building the future of mobility with America, in America," Chung said then. Chung, who is 54 years old, took over the business from his father in 2020, becoming the third-generation leader of Hyundai Motor Group. From the start, the company had ties with the U.S. The original land that Hyundai sat upon in Seoul was bought from the American military. Chung cuts a different figure than his father and grandfather, who are both icons in the Korean business community. This Chung has preferred being driven around in colorful company cars, not the conventional black, and fashions himself as an outspoken technologist after earning his MBA in Silicon Valley during the 1990s dot-com boom. His love for basketball prompted Kia to become a sponsor of the NBA dunk contest in 2011. That year's winner, Blake Griffin, leapt over a Kia Optima for the showcase moment. And behind the scenes, Chung, who often goes by ES in the West, also is known to fraternize comfortably with Hyundai staff, the company's auto dealers, and others. John Krafcik, a former CEO of Hyundai Motor America, recalled an evening karaoke session in Seoul more than a decade ago when Chung grabbed a mic and belted out Queen's Radio Gaga. Chung, who was vice chairman of Hyundai Motor at the time, then brought out his drum kit and played a few more songs. He's never been afraid to show a real human side, Krafchik said. That everyone recognizes that Chung is the ultimate boss allows Hyundai, even today, to operate in a founder's mode. That means the company isn't likely to stray strategically despite short-term setbacks, said Krafchik, who left the firm in 2013. Chung is also not averse to playing politics. In June 2024, Kemp, the Georgia governor, visited South Korea for economic meetings. Hyundai's Meta plant was the state's largest ever manufacturing investment. He found himself sightseeing on Jeju Island, a resort island famous for sweet mandarins and volcanic rock statues. But he needed transport back to Seoul. Chung, who had accompanied Kemp with other senior company officials to Jeju Island, offered his private jet, according to people familiar with the matter. Kemp accepted, eventually flying out on the jet while Chung and Hyundai's top brass flew about an hour to the South Korean capital on a commercial Korean Air flight. Just days after the U.S. election, Chung tapped the Spanish-born Jose Munoz as Hyundai Motor CEO, the first non-Korean to lead the automaker. The move underscored Chung's desire to embark on an era of quote-unquote performance over passport. Munoz, a former lieutenant to Carlos Ghosn at Nissan, who had been running Hyundai's U.S. operations, had a global profile. The appointment also reflected the growing importance of the U.S. to Hyundai's business. Now more than 1 in 10 new vehicles sold in the U.S. are Hyundai or Kia, including Ioniq EVs, Elantra sedans, and Sportage SUVs. On Thursday, the company said September sales in the U.S. had increased 14% from the prior year. But Trump's tariffs, in effect since April, contributed to a 22% drop in net profit during its most recent quarter from the prior year. The automaker hasn't raised prices despite the tariffs. After a Biden-era tax credit for EVs expired, Hyundai said from this month it would slash prices or offer a cash incentive. Part of Hyundai's increased focus on the U.S. is due to a drop-off in business elsewhere. In 2016, Hyundai and Kia achieved all-time sales records in China, collectively selling around 1.8 million vehicles and grabbing 7% of the country's overall market at the time, according to estimates by Korea Investment and Securities. The following year, Chinese backlash emerged over South Korea's installation of a U.S. missile defense system. Photos of vandalized Hyundai and Kia cars emerged then on Chinese social media. Hyundai and Kia currently represent less than 1% of the Chinese market. Hyundai and Kia were Russia's most popular auto brands in 2021, but Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine the following year halted the Korean firm's operations there due to supply chain issues. Hyundai sold off its plant in St. Petersburg in 2023. The U.S. is a market that is simply too important to ever give up on, said Kim Jang-ho, a former Kia investor relations manager who is now an auto analyst at Korea Investment and Securities. Hyundai began operating at its first U.S. manufacturing plant 2 decades ago in Montgomery, Alabama. 4 years later, the company opened the Kia factory south of Atlanta. Hyundai and Kia currently make about 40% of the vehicles sold in the U.S. locally, with the remaining bulk still made largely in South Korea. By 2030, executives want local U.S. production to account for 80% of the local sales. The ultra-modern Metaplant complex outside Savannah, targeted by the immigration raid, is central to those hopes. There, yellow robotic arms lurch down from the ceiling, grabbing parts, welding, and attaching doors. Of the 317 South Korean workers detained at the EV battery construction site, more than half had entered the U.S. through the Electronic System for Travel Authorization Visa Waiver Program, known as ESTA, that allows tourism and short-term business travel, according to records released by a South Korean lawmaker. Nearly everyone else had held a B-1 business visitor visa and B-2 tourist visa. Late last month, the U.S. clarified that South Koreans traveling on the B-1 visa and ESTA are allowed to, quote, install service or repair, close quote, equipment brought from overseas to build plants in the U.S., according to Seoul's foreign ministry. Washington also agreed to soon open a special visa desk at the U.S. Embassy in Seoul, which will field relevant inquiries. It was with an ESTA that Cho Young-hee, one of the South Koreans who had been detained, traveled into Georgia. He is an LG Energy equipment engineer, and despite a difficult week behind bars, Cho, who is back in Korea, said after returning home that he would like to return to Georgia to quote-unquote finish the job. It's the only way the factory will be set up and ready for fellow American workers to take over in the future, he said. And that's the end of the Wall Street Journal report. Hyundai gets cold shoulder from Trump despite charm offensive. It was reported by Timothy Martin and Jiyoung Son. And I'll remind you, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the Wall Street Journal program, and I'm your volunteer reader, Paul Weick. Next, let's read the Herd on the Street column. It is headlined, How Trump Threw a Wrench into Credit Markets. Tariffs and other policy swings are exposing strains at highly indebted companies. And Telos Demos is today's Herd on the Street reporter. Leverage combined with dramatic policymaking is proving to be a volatile mix. Earlier this year, investors held their breath as the extent of President Trump's tariff policies were laid out. But in the months that followed, it also became evident that the impact on the large businesses that comprise the S&P 500 may be mostly manageable. The index has since surged to all-time highs. That doesn't mean any policy effects went away, and some companies that are more vulnerable to policy changes, either by the narrower nature of their business or because they had more fragile financial underpinnings, are feeling it. That, in turn, is creating headaches for the Wall Street ecosystem that has extended credit to these companies. Many of these businesses are not publicly listed or well-known, but they are important cogs in the markets they serve and employ large numbers of people. Changes to things like tariffs, healthcare spending, or immigration policy are rarely cited as the sole cause of any company's trouble. But the strain that policy changes may be putting on companies or their customers have been noted as events that have helped exacerbate other issues. Another common factor is a heavy debt load, a rise that some investors worry has been accumulating in an exuberant and fast-growing market for company debts. There are even concerns about cases of fraud which have sometimes flourished in buoyant markets. In late September, auto parts supplier First Brands Group filed for bankruptcy. According to a court filing from the company's chief restructuring officer, recent geopolitical uncertainty and headwinds from newly imposed tariffs have pressurized global supply chains and layered additional complications on the company's operations. That's his quote. These included the company spending about $220 million on things such as pre-buying inventory and increasing its investment in a project to produce certain parts in the U.S., according to the filing. At the same time, the company faced mounting funded debt and lease obligations, the filing said, and these factors all snowballed into a liquidity crisis. The bankruptcy is complicated as the company used forms of off-balance sheet financing. Outside directors installed that the company are investigating the ways in which account receivables were used to secure the financing, the Wall Street Journal has reported. Other recent bankruptcies have also cited the effects of tariffs. In June, auto parts supplier Marelli filed for bankruptcy protection. The company's chief executive in a court filing cited macroeconomic headwinds associated with the imposition of tariffs in countries around the world. Those headwinds cast uncertainty on the company's forecast and ability to service a large capital structure that would be magnified by the quantum of new financing required, the filing said. Yeah, that sounds like a bankruptcy filing. Home decor retailer At Home Group also filed for bankruptcy in June. A court filing cited tariffs, including on imports from China, where it sources many of its goods, as a factor complicating its efforts to address its liquidity and manage its debt load. In September, auto lender Tricolor Holdings filed for a Chapter 7 liquidation. The causes of its bankruptcy also appear to be complex. The Journal has reported that one of the company's bank financing partners has alleged fraud related to the collateral used to secure financing. Before its bankruptcy, a different policy swing out of Washington had caused concern about the company's lending. A June presale report by S&P Global Ratings Structured Finance Group on a tricolor securitization noted that the lender's market niche included many immigrants, and that changes in immigration policies and enforcement are an event risk that could lead to higher delinquency and loss levels. That was the presale report, the June presale report by S&P Global Ratings. So far, despite recent bankruptcies, there has not been a surge in defaults in some key markets. Even accounting for First Brand's bankruptcy, the trailing 12-month payment default rate as of the end of September on a Morningstar LSTA index of U.S. leveraged loans was only 1.47% of the loan amounts, still well below the post-pandemic peak of 1.75% that was hit in July of 2023, according to figures compiled by PitchBook LCD. Still, a relative paucity of visible failures is not the same thing as an all-clear signal for all borrowers. Morningstar DBRS, in a September report, said that among some of the weakest middle-market borrowers, there has not been any notable strengthening of operating performance, and that this trend may be exacerbated next year by incremental stress from tariffs or further acceleration in economic activity. End of the quote. Though recent problems have surfaced for borrowers in the auto industry or in retail, other sectors also may have vulnerabilities. A report from ratings agency KBRA recently cited emerging setbacks to roll-ups of healthcare practices, which collectively carry about $45 billion in total debt. Their possible challenges include the potential for lower reimbursement rates from Medicare and Medicaid to squeeze their profitability, the report said. Many companies will muddle through new challenges as they did the pandemic or surges in interest rates. Some will even benefit from policy changes like tax cuts or a shift to domestic production or get a lift from Federal Reserve rate cuts. And even in the best of times, some borrowers will run into idiosyncratic problems. But investors struggling to understand why some people are worried about the economy, even when stock indexes are flying high, might find explanations within less visible parts of the market. And that was the column from Telus Demos, the Herd on the Street column, How Trump Threw a Wrench into Credit Markets. Well, let's see. What article shall we read next? How about this opinion column from the Wall Street Journal? It's from the editorial board, and it fits in with some of our previous reading as well. The incredible expanding Fannie Mae. Trump and Pulte now want the government mortgage giants to subsidize home builders. And like I said, this is from the editorial board. President Trump has heard that home builders are struggling amid his tariff blitz, immigration crackdown, and weak sales. His solution? Get government-sponsored enterprises Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to subsidize them. Here we go again. Mr. Trump pitched this idea in a Truth Social post on Sunday. Before I became president, OPEC kept oil prices high. It wasn't right for them to do that, but in a different form is being done again, this time by the big home builders of our nation, he wrote. So he is accusing the home builders of colluding to restrict housing supply? But wait, he added, they're my friends and they're very important to the success of our country, but now they can get financing and they have to start building homes. They're sitting on 2 million empty lots, a record. I'm asking Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to get big home builders going and by so doing, help restore the American dream. That's the end of his Truth Social post. Bill Pulte, the president's political fixer who oversees Fannie and Freddie, saluted his boss. Quote, we will do just that at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, end quote. What Mr. Pulte means by just that is the trillion-dollar question. Fannie and Freddie guarantees mortgages, including some loans for people building their own homes, but the government-sponsored Godzillas currently don't finance home builders. It's unclear where Mr. Trump picked up the idea that home builders are sitting on 2 million empty lots. The Census Bureau shows that about 250,000 homes have received permits but have not yet begun construction. Perhaps his confusion stems from the current housing market affordability paradox? State and local governments have suppressed construction over many years, while the feds and Fannie and Freddie have goosed demand. This has resulted in a housing shortage and pushed up prices. Historic low mortgage rates during the pandemic drove up prices even more. Home prices have climbed 55% since January 2020. Many Americans now can't afford to buy a home at today's higher mortgage rates and home prices. Those who locked in low mortgage rates in 2020 or 2021 often can't afford to move if they need a new mortgage for their next home. So demand for newly built homes is weak. Home builders are enticing buyers with discounts and offers to pay down their mortgage rates for a few years with the hope that rates will later fall and let borrowers refinance. Nearly 4 in 10 builders cut prices last month, and 65% said they dangled incentives, according to the National Association of Home Builders. They've also put the brakes on new projects. This will make it harder to expand supply to bring down prices over the long term. There is little that Fannie and Freddie can legally do under their existing federal charters to support home builders. Guaranteeing construction loans to big home builders is beyond their remit, and subsidizing borrowers to buy new homes would likely push up home prices. The two mortgage giants are also undercapitalized, even as Messrs. Pulte and Trump talk about letting them break free of government conservatorship and float IPOs. Expanding the role in housing even more is one of the worst ideas we've heard in an era too full of them. If Mr. Trump wants to help his home builder friends, he could drop his tariffs, stop deporting their workers, and appoint a Federal Reserve chair with market credibility to defeat inflation. Ooh, strong opinion piece by the editorial board, the incredible expanding Fannie Mae. The subheadline was Trump and Pulte now want the government mortgage giants to subsidize home builders. Editorial board not having any of that. Okay, well, let's finish up with this article from the business section. Bosses are cutting costs, just not the private jet. Corporate spending on charter flights is soaring to the dismay of workers being told to make do with less. It's reported by Callum Borchers. For an economy with so much talk of efficiency, there sure is a lot of money to spare for executives to fly on private jets. A slight majority of the 500 largest U.S. companies by revenue now pay for their CEOs to fly private, according to executive data firm Equilar. While many of these companies are reducing headcount and asking their remaining employees to do more with less, their collective spending on private air travel is 76.7% higher than in 2020. Meta Platforms, which has gone through rounds of layoffs in recent years, paid $1.5 million to charter flights for chief executive Mark Zuckerberg last year. Zuckerberg owns a jet and bills his company when he uses it for business travel. I guess this is the C-suite version of you and me putting in for mileage reimbursements when we drive our own cars on work trips. On top of $36 million in salary bonus and stock awards last year, J.P. Morgan Chase threw in $293,753 of personal travel on a company jet for CEO Jamie Dimon. Personal use of corporate planes is an increasingly popular perk, and businesses tend to report the value of the benefit at less than market rate. Executive perks in general have gotten less lavish as Americans developed a more populist sensibility after the financial crisis of the aughts. A lot of companies stopped picking up the tab for country club memberships and curbed gross-up payments, which make perks even sweeter by covering the taxes that accompany them. But private air travel has survived, nay soared, amid other cutbacks. Corporate security filings tout the relative modesty of executive benefits. Many underscore the absence of golden parachutes and Cadillac healthcare plans. Some companies don't even provide Cadillacs anymore. This is a response to public scrutiny of business leaders who are often perceived as overpaid and out of touch. Ironically, criticism is the very thing that drives companies to spend more money flying execs around on private jets. Charter flights are the surest way to keep CEOs safe from people who might act on their grievances. It's a tough thing to hear for rank and file employees, but security is a big reason why spending has been so high, says Amit Batish, a senior director at Equilar. Executives, especially high-profile ones, don't want to travel publicly. To be competitive today, you're going to have to shell out to keep them happy. That's the end of Batish's quote. Batish and others who monitor private jet usage point to last year's killing of UnitedHealth CEO Brian Thompson as a wake-up call. Though it did not happen at an airport, the killing reinforced the importance of security measures, which increasingly include private air travel as a key component. Even for executives who want to look like they are sharing employees' sacrifice during leaner times, the jet is one thing they won't compromise. Zuckerberg for years has drawn a $1 base salary, but his $27.2 million in other compensation last year included a $14 million allowance for security and about $2.6 million for personal use of a private jet. Atlassian CEO Mike Cannon-Brookes wrote on LinkedIn this year that he feels a, quote, deep internal conflict, close quote, about flying private, given his profile as a climate activist, but threats are, quote, an unfortunate reality of my world, end quote, he explained. Cannon-Brookes also contended his private jet trips remove more carbon from the air than they admit, using direct air capture technology. Are we to believe that private air travel is all about saving lives and the planet? The National Business Aviation Association provides talking points that companies can use to justify their use of private jets. Most center on reducing travel time and making executives more productive. Those are valid reasons, but let's be real, pampering is a factor too. Some businesses turned to charter flights when commercial options were limited during the pandemic, says Greg Brunson-Pitts, CEO of Advanced Aviation Team, a private jet brokerage. Once you go private, it's hard to go back. Brunson-Pitts' team caters to clients' tastes with in-flight food from their favorite restaurants and quote-unquote really nice swag bags. Think of like a cashmere blanket with your name stitched on it, or some really comfortable slippers, he says. A productivity boost indeed. Then there are companies like Starbucks, which pays for CEO Brian Nicole to commute via private jet from his home in Southern California to the corporate headquarters in Seattle on a hybrid schedule. The cushy arrangement irks a lot of employees as the coffee chain is enforcing a return-to-office mandate, closing cafes, and laying off workers, says Christine McHugh, a former Starbucks vice president. Now an independent management consultant, McHugh maintains relationships within the company and is coaching some people who were recently laid off. She says using a private jet for business meetings is one thing, but when it's for your personal commute to and from the office, that seems over the top to me, end quote. Starbucks did not respond to a request for comment. On the balance sheets of multi-billion dollar companies, the cost of private aviation is a drop in the bucket of jet fuel. Reducing or eliminating charter flights is not likely to change major decisions like layoffs. For frustrated workers, the issue is optics. Jennifer Peters, who lives in the Atlanta area, has been looking for a new software job since being laid off in March. She has gone through several rounds of interviews a few times, only to be told that hiring for those positions is frozen. It's hard to accept that a company can't afford to hire her when her expected salary would be a fraction of the CEO's private jet budget. It makes me shake my fist because it's a lot of hypocrisy, she says. Businesses can rationalize private air travel all they want. That won't stop it from being a bad look in the eyes of many. And that was an article in the business section from Callum Borchers. Bosses are cutting costs, just not the private jet. Well, that brings us to the end of today's edition of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Paul Weick, your volunteer reader here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us, and stay tuned for more interesting programs here on Sun Sounds.